This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Of the Medrash that I started last night, the Medrash based on the Pasuk in Mishlei, Birtzos Hashem Darkei Ish, when the Ribbono Shel Olam is pleased with the ways of a man, Gam Oyovov Yashlim Itzoi, then his enemies will also make peace with him. Which is an interesting approach to the resolution of conflict, that it lies in the stature of the individual rather than in the solution of the conflict. And normally we say, you don't have to, conflicts are not personal, you don't have to get into the personal issues. Just resolve the problems and concentrate on the issues. Here we see it's not so, but it says Hashem Darkeish. It's only when the Ribbono Shel Olam approves of the way a person functions, when a person functions in a way that is satisfactory to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then Hashem takes care of the enemies, and they'll be mashlim, they'll make peace with him. So it's exactly the opposite of the traditional way, or the normal way of current thinking, where the concentration is, yes, concentrate on the people, not on the issue. Forget the issue. Concentrate on the people. If you're the right kind of person, the issue will get resolved. And the Gemara brings several examples. We're going to deal with two of them. We'll firstly deal with the last example that the Medrash brings. But it says Hashem Darkei Ish. Who is the Ish? Who is the man that Hashem is talking about? And there too there's an implication of stature, that when a person functions as a man, as an Ish, then his enemies will make peace with him. Zeh Avraham. That's Avraham Shenikro Ish, because he's called an Ish. Gam Oyovov, and who are Avraham's enemies? Zeh Avimelech, that's Avimelech. Where do we see that Avimelech is such an enemy of Avraham? What occurs that gives us the impression of him being such an enemy? All we're told is that he goes to Geror, and when asked, he says about Soro that she is his sister. If he's his sister, there's nothing wrong. Avimelech invites her over to the palace. Hashem appears to him in a dream and says, don't touch her, she's married. Avimelech comes to Avraham and says, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you tell me she's your sister? And Avraham explains. And so they go on. And Avimelech gives them enormous gifts. He gives a soyun uvoko ba'avodim ushvochus, sheep and cattle and servants and maidservants by yitin la'Avraham. He gives them to Avraham. And he gives back Asorah, of course. And he says, here's my land before you, dwell wherever you want. And to Soro he gives 1,000 silver coins. And also, Avraham prays for Avimelech. Avimelech is healed, and so on. No sign of any enmity. Later on, they say, Avimelech and Fichol, his general, say to Avraham, Hashem is clearly with you. We would like you to take an oath that you and your descendants will deal well and kindly with us and our descendants. And Avraham swears. And they make a deal together. Avraham says it wasn't very nice what you did with the wells. He gives him a little bit of musa. Avraham says, I'm sorry, I didn't know about it. Very nice, very civil. There's absolutely no indication anywhere of enmity. And the Medrash says, who is the enemy of Avraham who ultimately makes peace with him? Avimelech is the enemy. Where do we see that enmity? There's only one hint at it, and that is Vayomer Avimelech el Avraham. Avimelech says to Avraham, Moro iso ki osiso es hadover hazeh. What made you do this? What made you come to my country and introduce your wife as your sister? What occurred? What happened that made you do such a thing? Explains Avraham. By Yomer Avraham, Avraham answers, Ki omarti, I said to myself, after observing your country, your society, Rak ein yirat Elokim b'mochtum hazeh. There's only an absence of Yirat Shamayim. There's no God fearing in this place. And therefore, v'haroguni al davar ishti, they will kill me to get my wife. What does it mean they'll kill me to get my wife? Because there's no God fearing, they won't mind killing me. If there's no God-fearing in their wife, why bother killing him? Why not take his wife without killing him? So you see, there is some kind of God-fearing. So the Rachaim HaKodesh explains, there's diminished God-fearing. And they feel that by killing him is less serious avero than taking his wife while he's alive. They actually make the calculation, they figure out, if they kill him, it's one issur, it's murder, you do it once. And there are ways to minimize it as well. You can get a whole lot of people to participate, and then each one sort of shares in it. Nobody does it all by themselves. And if one person does the murder, then at least only one person, that's the end of the story. But to take away his wife and leave him alive, every time they have relations with his wife, that's a serious issur. No, that's tzadikim, they don't want to do such a thing, they would rather just kill him. So it's less of an issur to kill him than to force his wife to be unfaithful to Avraham. So that's the calculation that Chaim HaKodesh says they went through. But we don't have to get that far. The Meir Soloveitchik told me that his father, the Bris Kerov, used to be medayik on this word rak. What does Avraham say? There is only one thing missing in this place, and that's Yiras Elokim. What does that mean, rak? Is that the only thing that was missing? That everything else was in order? Says the Bris Kerov, yes. Everything else was in order. The philosophy was good, the manners were good, the courtesy was good, the interpersonal relationships were good, the chesed was good, everything was wonderful. He could find no criticism of the land of Plishtim. He could find no criticism whatever about the way they behaved. They were exemplary in every way, rak, only one exception. There's only one thing I can fault this nation with. And that's Yiras Elokim. They don't have the fear of God. Do they believe in God? Yes, he doesn't say Emunas Elokim, he says Yiras Elokim. They believe in God, and they're fine people, and they're noble people, and they're cultured people, they're civilized people, they're polite people, they're a wonderful nation. Only Yiras Elokim isn't there. And what happens in a nation that might have everything else, all the culture, all the civility, all the nobility, all the refinement, everything except Yiras Elokim? The Huraguni, they can kill me. That doesn't stop murder. All the refinement, all the culture, all the nobility, all the civilization doesn't stop murder. That must. And perhaps 60 years ago we would have found that difficult to believe. How can that be? Cultured, civilized people will murder, they don't. Only the uncultured people that murder. Perhaps 60 or 70 years ago we would have found that difficult to believe. But today we don't. One of the reasons I believe implicitly that the Ribbono Shel Olam did what he did in Germany of all places is because Germany was the most cultured of all Western nations. The most noble, the most sophisticated, the most refined, the most polite. The place that dealt best with the Jews. The Jews felt more comfortable in Germany than anywhere else. And what did the Ribbono Shel Olam want to teach with that? Rak ein Yiras Elokim. That all that culture and all that civility and all that nobility and all that refinement means nothing whatsoever without Yiras Elokim. And that we had to learn, we had to see that functioning. Because this that I've just told you in the name of the Bris Kerov, we would have found an absurd statement 60 years ago. But not today. But perhaps even 60 years ago we wouldn't have found it so absurd, because that's what used to happen. What would happen if a man took a fancy in civilized countries, we're talking about noble countries, refined countries, until recently, what would happen if a man took a fancy to another man's wife? So he would start seeing her, he would start taking her out, he would start clandestinely meeting her. What happens when the first man finds out about it, when the husband finds out? What does he do in a civilized country? I challenge you to a duel, be a gentleman. What does a duel mean? Murder is okay. Take your wife, that's not a gentlemanly thing to do. If you want my wife, you deal with me. Let's fight it out. And one of us will die, that's fine. Murder. The Horaguni, even in civilized countries, the Horaguni al-Dvarishti, when it comes to a matter of arayas, we'll kill each other for that. And I perceive that, says Avraham Avinu, that rak ein Yiras Elokim, ultimate sophistication in every area of human conduct, that there was still the possibility of murder. Not the possibility, the probability. Not maybe they'll kill me. The Harogumi, they would kill me for my wife. That's what it means. Why? Because there's no Yiras Elokim. And the mayor said to me, he thinks the Malbim says the same. The Malbim says it slightly differently. The Malbim says, and don't forget, the Bris Kerov said what I just told you after the war. But the Malbim said it long, long, long before that. Before that. If you see a person or a nation great in philosophy, V'chokak lo nimusim yeshorim, and through their philosophic understanding, they perceived the need and legislated straight and correct practice. V'hirgil es atzmon b'midos tovus al pi atza sichle, and using their own intellects, they accustomized themselves to fine behavior. V'hoesem mishpot usdoko, and they do justice. There's a sense of justice and uprightness and charity. It sounds like utopia. How kol ha'piatza sichle, they work it all out. B'chol zeh lo nuchal liftoach al ha'ish ahu o ha'am ahu. Nevertheless, we cannot be secure about that person or that nation. Shebe'et tesisehu ta'avosui la'asus ra shetamid yigbo sichle al ta'avosui. We cannot assume that every time they have a passion for evil, that their minds will overcome their passions. Ki behefech eis tevayu b'eish ta'avosui il eish eschei. Because when there's really a burning passion for his friend's wife or money, when nobody's looking, then his seichel also disappears. He'll murder, he'll commit adultery, he'll do anything if nobody's watching. There is only one power that a man has, Asher boi nuchal liftach shiloi necheto, through which we can trust that there is a resistance to sin. There's only one thing that builds in an inherent resistance to sin, vehi midas hayiro, and that is the midah of yiro, of God fearing, hashetulo benefesh, which is implanted in the soul. Shemimeno yistoev seif echod, shehi yiras aliki. From that comes the one principle which is Yiras Shemayim, Eis Tamale Anefesh Miyiras Elokim Hamashkif Al Negleyu V'Nistoro V'Atzoifes Klomasov, the belief that is there is a God that watches everything, that can see everything, as Gam Eis Yigbar Olov Yitzrui, and even when a person's Yetzer becomes very powerful, Yi Yorei V'Yevosh Me'Amelech HaGodol HaRoyes Klomasov, he will be ashamed of the great king that sees everything, V'Yizoyim Ma'asos Ro, and he will be careful not to do evil. That's what the Malvim says. Slightly different emphasis, whereas what I was saying earlier in the name of the Bris Gerov, as I understood it, was not just that at a time of passion his seichel will disappear, but that even part of his philosophy is that there's nothing wrong with that, as we gave the example of the dueling. The Malbim says, and even if their philosophic practices are perfectly straight and nothing wrong with them whatever, even if they are incredibly refined and noble in the way they conduct one another, if there's no Yiras Elokim, at the end of the day there will be a time they will want something desperately, and if nobody will catch them, they'll do it. And it was actually an interesting discussion that I was having with Ramea Soloveitchik at the time, because from this came the question, so can a goy have Yiras Elokim as well? Is he expected to have Yiras Elokim? We must say yes, because a goy is chayim with the sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach. He's obligated to keep the mitzvahs b'nei noach, which includes theft and adultery and murder. All the things that Avraham says, without Yiras Elokim, there's no guarantee. That means the underlying principle to make sure that a non-Jew will stick even to the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach is Yiras Elokim. So who teaches them Yiras Elokim? Where are they supposed to learn Yiras Elokim from? From Avraham Avinu, from the Jewish people. That's what we're supposed to be teaching. If we teach Yiras Elokim, we don't have to worry about teaching anything else. They'll figure it all out themselves. If there's no Yiras Elokim, it doesn't help teaching them anything else, because they're not able to do it. And it's not just them, difficult to teach them when we have the problems within ourselves as well. But that says, that's how the Malbim understands the Pasuk. Rak ein Yiras Elokim b'amokim hazeh. The only thing that is missing here is Yiras Elokim. And with that missing, everything's missing. With that, my life is in danger. To be in a place where there's no Yiras Elokim, my life is in danger. And that's the oyev, that's the enemy. We would think, I gave you the example once, that the television interview that I saw in Israel just before the beginning of the Intifada, where young people were being asked, a train drew up at the station and one carriage had a Frum Jew sitting in it and another carriage had an Arab sitting in it, which carriage would you go into? And they all said they would feel more comfortable sitting in the carriage with the Arab. And I'm quite sure the same applied in Germany before the war. If you would have asked even possibly a fairly religious German Jew, if a train drew up and there was a German professor sitting in the one carriage and there was a Hasidic Yid from Poland sitting in the other carriage with his kapota and his long beard, where would you feel more comfortable? I have no doubt that the majority would have said they feel more comfortable sitting next to the Polish professor, next to the German professor rather than next to the Polish chosid. Because we think that if there is a veneer of refinement, if there is a veneer of politeness, if there is a veneer of courtesy, we think we have no enemies. Did the German Jews really think they had enemies in Germany? Their enemies were the Polish Jews, not the Germans. They were the enemies. They were threatening the Jewish people. Look how ostentatious they are about their Yiddishkeit. When we go about the streets, we don't wear a yarmulke. We don't wash. If we're at a banquet, we don't wash in public. People shouldn't see that. Mustn't be ostentatious about it. These Polish Jews come, and they're ostentatious about their Yiddishkeit. They're threatening our survival. They actually felt their survival more threatened by the Polish Hasidic Yid than by the German professor. More threatened. Because the German professor called him respectfully and spoke politely to him and was always meticulous in his courtesies, and he felt secure, he felt safe. It's not so at all. The Oyev is anyone or any nation that lacks Yiras Elokim. A nation or an individual that has no Yiras Elokim is a potential murderer. Whether that means physical murder or it means undermining in other ways and destroying in other ways, it doesn't matter. What we're saying here is an amazing concept that without Yiras Elokim, there's nothing. There is no bottom level. The only time there's a bottom level is when people are watching. When your friends are watching, when society is watching, when people are seeing, then we're careful what we do. But if nobody can see, if there's no Yiras Elokim, the person descends to the level of an animal. It makes absolutely no difference. I say that we have a certain advantage living in Africa. Because in Africa we have a chance to see what a goy is without Torah. Because don't forget, I emphasize it over and over again, don't forget the Western non-Jew, the Western Gentile that we meet normally, is a person who's been exposed to Torah principles for 2,000 years. He's been exposed to Old Testament, to the New Testament that is based on all sorts of Old Testament principles. He's been trained and schooled and exposed to the concepts of monotheism and to the concepts of the Torah for 2,000 years already he's been exposed to it. And even if you go to the Far East, in their Buddhism and their Shintoism, they've also absorbed all sorts of principles that originate in the Torah, despite all the Avodah Zarah that they put with it. But the fine principles they've absorbed. It's only really in Africa that you can see nations who have had no exposure whatever, except in the last 100 years, that have had no reasonable exposure whatever to the principles of Torah. And then you see what a goy really is. That's what it is. And the only difference between a German living in Berlin and an African in the jungle in the middle of Africa, the only difference is the veneer. There is no other difference. Scratch the veneer and you've got an African from the jungle. Just as cruel, just as violent. Yeah, the differences that we've discussed over the last 2 weeks, the different types of cultures. But in terms of the ability of that individual to descend to the ultimate depths of cruelty and deprivation, there is no difference whatever between the black man swinging from the trees in the middle of Africa and the German professor in Berlin. No difference. The only difference is the degree of exposure to Torah. The only difference is the degree of exposure to the principles of Torah, to the principles of monotheism. That's the only difference that there is. But if you take a guy as he was, just think back at the time we were first learning Torah, when we got the Torah, in the time of David HaMelech, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. Think what the other nations were. What were the people of Europe doing at that time? What were people in America doing in that time? What were Africans doing at that time? Just think that we were no less civilized then than we are now. We were a lot more civilized then than we were now. And they? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so there are two kinds of civilization. There's a civilization with Yiras Shamayim and there's a civilization without Yiras Shamayim. A goy who develops Yiras Elokim has the power to develop a true sense of refinement in the terms of Shevas B'nai Noach, and he won't murder and he won't commit adultery because he has Yiras Elokim. But if a goy doesn't have Yiras Elokim, or for that matter if a Jew doesn't have Yiras Elokim, what difference does it make? At the end of the day, if there's no Yiras Elokim, if there's no awareness, no perception of the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's nothing at all. And our enemies are not the people that appear to be necessarily the enemies. Our enemies are, at the end of the day, the people without Yiras Elokim. Eric said to me at the Shalashudas today, it's interesting to notice how worried the whole Jewish world was about who's going to win the elections. Who's it going to be in America? Is it going to be somebody who's good for Israel or somebody who's bad for Israel? But who is appointed Minister of Education in Israel itself, that doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. More important for us, who's President of America? We don't recognize where our enemies are. Sometimes they're very close to home. If there's no Yiras Elokim, it might be a cabinet minister in the state of Israel. There's the enemy of Israel. Not out in America. That's not where the enemies are. They can't do anything. It's within ourselves. It's very close to home. In the case of Avram, there's a man like Avimelech. And as we read through the parasha, Avimelech seems to be supportive. He seems to be caring. He wants to establish a bond with Avram. He's terribly upset that he transgressed the values of Avram Avinu. Unwittingly, he didn't intend to do so. And he has some kind of nevuah almost. He actually communicates with the Ribbono Shel Olam. So he believes in God. He's aware of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Would we suspect that that's the enemy of Avram? That that's the man that might wipe Avram out? Avram perceives it. He says yes. He sees right through all the politeness. He sees right through all the civility. He sees right through all the courtesy and caring. And he says there's no Yiras Elokim. And if there's no Yiras Elokim, there's nothing. And anything could happen. There is no limit to the depths to which we could descend in a society such as this. And he tells it to Avimelech. He tells him straight out. That's what I saw in your country. That's why I was scared to admit to the people here that this is my wife, because I knew my life would be in danger. And Avimelech doesn't deny it. He doesn't say, don't be silly, nobody would murder here. Not at all. He gives him gifts. Now the absence of Yiras Elokim means, in the simple sense of the word, it means fear of God. In a more sophisticated sense, it means perception of the Ribbono Shel Olam. This enmity, this enemy, the man who has no Yiras Elokim, who might be the most courteous person you know, who might tell you that some of his best friends are Jews or from Jews, this person, but he has no Yiras Elokim, how far from you is he? Could be anywhere in the world, but he could be somewhere very close. Says the Medrash in another section, who is this enemy of Birtzos Hashem Dar Keish Gam Oyevov Yashlimito? Who is this enemy that can make peace with you only when Hashem approves of your ways? Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Omazeh Yetzihara. That's the Yetzihara. It's part of you. This Avimelech is not somebody outside necessarily. It's the Yetzer Hara itself. The Yetzer Hara is also a delightful character. If we were to dress the Yetzer Hara up and characterize him, he wouldn't appear as a dressed in black with the horns under his hat and a tail and carrying around a fork. He wouldn't be like that at all. If we dressed the Yetzer Hara up, he would be very polite, incredibly smooth, very seductive, extremely well spoken, very caring and warm and supportive. How else would he get support if he wasn't able to communicate so well? If the Yetzer Hara looked like a devil, what kind of relationship would you want to have with him? You would chase him out. You wouldn't have two words to talk to him about. He doesn't look like that at all. The Yetzer Hara looks like a very fine person. The Yetzer Hara looks like a real gentleman, and he communicates well and makes you feel really good. That's why you want to keep close to him. That's who the Yetzer Hara is, just like Avimelech. What can I do for you and make yourself comfortable, and here are gifts for you and make yourself at home, and all I care about is your welfare, all I'm worried about is your well-being. Trust me, I'm honest, you can trust me, you don't have to, you know, as soon as people start saying that, trust me, I'm honest, I'm okay, all I have is your welfare is concerned. You know you're talking to the Yetzer Hara. When people start like that, you know for sure. You must just see the horns and the tail when they start talking like that. You know for sure that that's the Yetzer Hara. That's what he looks like. So this Avimelech doesn't have to be an Avimelech outside. This Avimelech can be inside. Real polite and courteous. The German professor lives right inside us. And he's called the Yetzer Hara. And he too is a being without Yiras Elokim. He has everything. He has charm. He has intellect. He has communication. He has warmth. He has everything you admire. Rak in Yiratzelikim. The one thing he doesn't have is he's not afraid of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's all. And that's what we have to watch out for. Because if he's not afraid for the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Haroguni, he'll destroy me, he'll kill me. There's no limit to how far he won't go, he'll go in order to achieve his ends. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't count at all. There is no Yiratzelikim. Somebody asked me some time ago, and I don't remember who it was, if he's present here or he isn't, about what happens after the time of the Mashiach with the Yetzer Hara. There's a Ramban in Dvorim, in Parshas Netzovim, Perik Lamed, Posuk Vov, Umar Hashem Elokecho es Levovcho ves Levav Zarecho li'ahavo. And Hashem will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your seed to love Hashem with all your heart and with all your might in order that you live. Says the Ramban, Yegale einecho losur mikol tous ma'arbei vasechel miyedi asaemes. The Ribbono Shel Olam will open your eyes so that you will move away, you will depart from any mistake that confuses the mind from knowing the truth. I'm reading you a piece of Sipurna, as interesting as that was, and as correct as it is, that the Ramban says, Ki mizman habriya, from the beginning of creation, hoyoso rushus ha'odon la'asos kirtzoino, people have been given absolute free will. Tzadik or Rosho, you want to be a tzadik, you want to be a Rosho, you can do what you want. The chol's man ha-Torah came, and so it is throughout the period of the Torah. Kedei shiyeh Elohim zchus bevechirosom betoiv, uva'oinesh kirtzoinom bera. So that they will have reward for choosing good, and punishment for choosing bad. Avol limois ha-Moshiach, but when Moshiach comes, tiyeh ha-bechiro betoiv lohem teva. There will be a natural choice for that which is good. And that doesn't mean that there won't be a Yetzer Hara at all. But that means the same as we don't have a craving, no matter how cold it is, you don't have a craving to jump into a fire. Because you know that will destroy you. So it is in the time of Mashiach, no matter how much you might want to do something, you're not going to do it because you know how it will destroy you. You'll just see the truth so clearly. Lo yisave lohem halev lemashein roi. And consequently, the heart won't crave for something which is not fitting. The lo yachbet boi klalam will have no desire for it. Vehi hamilo an iskeres kan. And this is the circumcision about which it's talking. Ki achemdo vahataiva oilo lelev. Because passion and desire is the foreskin of the heart. And when the Torah says Hashem will circumcise the heart, that means he will not have that craving and that passion. And that means that at that time man will revert to the way they were before Adam Arishon, where he naturally did that which was correct to do, and he never wanted to do the opposite, only that which was good. So we'll get back to the situation before the chet. That's what the Ramban says it means. And somebody asked me, but what chance do we have? Adam HaRishon, who was created by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Adam HaRishon, he had no distractions. And there was no Sunday Times newspaper in Adam HaRishon's time. And there were none of all the other distractions that we have. And he couldn't withstand it. Within a minute of being created, he'd already disobeyed the Ribbono Shel Olam and created the Yetzer Hara right inside him. When we get back to that stage, how long are we going to last? Aren't we just going to repeat ourselves? And the same for a moment, we'll be on that level of the pre-Adam HaRishon state. And sooner or later, somebody's going to make a mistake. If Adam can do it, somebody else can do it. And we'll be back to square one. What's going to be gained? What guarantee have we got that after Mashiach comes, in what way are we going to be better after Mashiach comes than we were before? And the answer lies in this very Medrash. Because the Medrash says, Beretzos Hashem Darkei Ish. When Hashem approves of the way of a man, Gam Oyovov, it doesn't say Gam Oyovov Yamusu. His enemies will die. His enemies will disappear. It doesn't say that. Gam Oyovov Yashlimito. His enemies will make peace with him. What happens when an enemy makes peace? He doesn't disappear out of your life. When an enemy makes peace, he supports you, he helps you, he works for you. Different thing altogether. It's turning enmity into friendship. It's not ceasing enmity, it is not putting an end to enmity. It is converting enmity into friendship. As Avram did with Avimelech. And what does the Medrash say? One of these enemies that we're talking about is the Avimelech inside us, the Yetzer Hara. The idea is not to remove the Yetzer Hara from us. The idea is not to isolate the Yetzer Hara from us. The idea is Yashlimito, the Yetzer Hara becomes an integrated part of our personality, dedicated together with our Yetzer Hatov to the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the ultimate idea. And we see certain interesting things, and some of it we touched on in the ladies' shiur this morning. We're discussing the difference between Shavuos and Purim. The Gemara says in Shabbos and Daf Peches and Vadalef, "Vayishyatzvu betachti sahar." They stood under the mountain. It says, "What does it mean? They stood under the mountain." So the way we translate it is that they stood at the foot of the mountain. But the literal translation is that they stood under the mountain. Omer Rav Avdimi bar Chama bar Chaso. Melamed shekofo hakodesh baruch hu aleihem esahor kegigis. So it teaches us that the Ribbono Shel Olam turned the mountain over them like a barrel. V'yomar aleihem, and said to them, "Im atem mekablim atoyra mutov, v'im lav shamteik v'roschem." You have two choices. You either accept the Torah or I drop the mountain on you. Choose whichever you want. Which is a strange Gemara, because Rabbi Nisro were praised for accepting the Torah. And you know the lovely Medrash Hashem went around to all the nations and said to them, "Do you want the Torah?" And they said, "What's written in it?" He said, "You mustn't steal." They said, "Oh, you mustn't steal. How are we going to earn a living?" "No, thank you, we don't want the Torah." Went to another nation, "What's written in it?" "You mustn't murder. You're not going to murder. How are we going to cope?" "No, thank you." Eventually came to the Bnei Yisrael, and they said, "Nice, Ebenishma, sure, yes, absolutely. Thank you very much. He made us an offer we couldn't refuse. And that he made the same offer to the other nations, would they have refused it?" So what was the big thing of Kabbalah Satorah? What was the big thing that we did in accepting the Torah, if that's what Hashem did, if He held the mountain over us? So we explained that what it means is not literally Hashem didn't hold the mountain. Hashem simply revealed the truth to us to such an extent that in the face of the truth we had no choice. That's all. In the face of the truth you have no choice. And I gave them the example, if you walked around with an electronic mechanism attached to your head with an explosive on the side of the head, bandaged onto the side of the head, and a sensor in your brain, and the doctor that installed that tells you the first word that comes close to smelling of Lashon Hara, this thing goes off, detonates, and your brain will be splattered on the walls around you like you just can't imagine, and it'll be an unsightly mess for those around you. You won't feel anything, so don't worry. But you wouldn't want to do that to your wife and family, because they'll have to clean your brains off the walls around you. The first word that just smells of Lashon Hara, you should know. And if you want to see it work, come, we'll show you. And they say, "Yeah, you come." They call somebody and they say, "Say a word of Lashon Hara." And he says, just begins a word that's just Avat Lashon Hara. And you just see him explode. And you just see his brain. He says, "Okay, I believe it, all right." He says, "That's it, now off you go." What would you do? You wouldn't speak, Poshut, that's all. You would just get a sign language, you wouldn't speak. Not a word, not an absolute word. But that's what the Torah tells us. A word of Lashon Hara and I blow your brains out. That's all your spiritual brains. And we carry on talking Lashon Hara. Why? Because it's not clear to us. We don't visualize, we don't see it. That's all that happened at Har Sinai. The Ribbono Shel Olam just showed them what really happens if you don't accept the Torah. Just see what really happens. Anybody who understands what really happens when you don't accept the Torah accepts it very quickly. You know, like the joke, that boss explains it better. Once you really understand it, once there's no question about the consequences, that's it. You do it. There's no question, there's no discussion. That's kofa aleim har kegigis. That's what it means. Hashem suspended the mountain. He revealed the truth of the Torah to them in a way which gave them no option. So why are we praised for receiving it? Why are we praised for what we did? Because we perceived it. Other nations didn't see it. We saw it. We were able to see that reality. Other nations were not able to see that reality. But the fact remains that absolute acceptance of the Torah. Imagine again, let's go back to our example. They've now installed the detonator in your brain and the explosives on the outside of your head, and it's all well in place. And they say to you now, "Tell us, are you quite Are you willing to go ahead with this? In other words, are you just telling us you won't talk Lashon Hara, or do you really mean that you won't talk Lashon Hara? What are you going to say? With all my heart, I assure you, I will not talk Lashon Hara. You don't have to worry. Never, ever am I going to say a word that comes ever near to Lashon Hara. I might not even say one word altogether. That may be. But I might just stop speaking. But you don't have to worry. I am absolutely committed to this. And when Bnei Yisrael accepted the Torah, was there any question about the degree of their commitment? Absolutely not. They knew exactly what the consequences would be. What happens 2 days later? They're dancing around the golden calf. How do you explain it? After seeing all that, 2 days later they're dancing around the golden calf. The answer is that when a commitment is the result of an external form of compulsion, the commitment is there only for so long as the compulsion is there. Remove the compulsion and you remove the commitment. Simple as that. And that's life. That's how people are. If you want to compel people to do things, you'll succeed. But the moment the compulsion is no longer evident to the person, he's going to stop doing it. The moment he thinks that maybe the detonator is not working anymore, or he has any kind of proof that it's not working anymore, he'll start talking Lashon Hara and he'll make up for all the time he didn't. He'll be this tremendous relief. He won't have got into the habit of not talking Lashon Hara. It will all come out, pouring out, 100 words a moment, to get all that Lashon Hara out that's been pent up inside him before. Because there was never really a commitment to start with. The commitment was dependent on a form of external compulsion. Is that Yiras Shamayim? Yes, it's a form of Yiras Shamayim. As long as the detonator's there, I won't murder people. As long as the detonator's there, I won't talk Lashon Hara. But is it something that really comes from within one? No. So we see there are two kinds of Yiras Shamayim. There's a Yiras Shamayim which is an external compulsion, and then there's a different kind of Yiras Shamayim altogether. And that's what happened at Purim. When Bnei Yisrael were able to be Mekiyimu Mashikiblu Kfar, the Gemara goes on to say, Omar Rova, Afal Pikein, Hadur Kiblua Bimea Chashverush. The generation did accept the Torah willingly in the time of Achashverush. Dichtiv Kiyimu Vekiblu Ayyuhudim Kiyimu Mashikiblu Kfar. In the time of Achashverush, in the time of Purim, the Jews voluntarily accepted that which was they were compelled to accept earlier on. And here it wasn't God holding the barrel over their heads, because this was after the time. It was after Haman was killed. It was after Haman's sons were hanged. It was after Purim and Shushan Purim, when all the people in Shushan and the surrounding towns had been killed. After that it says Kimu the Kiblu. They'd already been saved. And it was an act of gratitude, not an act of fear. It was in response to what had taken place already, not out of fear of what might happen. When the Jews accepted the Torah at Sinai, it was out of the fear of the consequences of not accepting the Torah. When the Jews accepted the Torah in Purim, it was out of gratitude of what had already taken place. It was an appreciation of what the Ribbono Shel Olam had already done for them. And so we see from here, by the way, an approach to motivation. You're going to motivate people by external forms of compulsion. As long as the compulsion is there, the motivation will work. Take the compulsion away, it will stop working. And it doesn't matter. The world thinks they've become very clever in changing compulsion from sticks to carrots. Whereas in the old days it used to be, if you don't work, you'll lose your job. Now it is, if you work well, you can get a bonus. And I think, isn't this a difference? Look what's going to happen to productivity now. But they're both forms of external compulsion. They're both external. Both of them are saying, you're just phrasing it differently. Both of them are saying, if you don't work, you'll earn less. You can say, if you do work, you'll earn more, but it's exactly the same. The consequences of your not working are going to be lower earnings. So as long as that Harakagigis is there, as long as that mountain is over their heads, they will be compelled. They will comply out of a sense of compulsion. The moment you remove that, they'll go back to their own old ways. There is no internal change that brings about inside a person. Nothing at all. And in fact, the question is asked, how do we see in Purim that they were Mekayim, that they voluntarily accepted? And the answer is given because they added the mitzvah of Megillah. And Rabbi Yeruchim says, you see from there, it's the addition, doing more than you have to do, which demonstrates a true sense of commitment. Where there's compulsion, you will do only what you're compelled to do, nothing more than that. You won't do one thing more than that. When there's an internal sense of commitment, you will do much more than you're expected to do because it comes from within you. The fact that Bnei Yisrael legislated a new mitzvah, the reading of the Megillah, demonstrates the fact that there was commitment, not compulsion. They weren't just keeping the mitzvahs, they were making new mitzvahs already. They were going beyond that which was expected of them. That's commitment, that's something altogether different. And so when it comes to Yerushalayim, there are two kinds of Yerushalayim, and both of them deal with the Yetzer Hara in different ways. Yes, we said there's a Yetzer Hara, and the Yetzer Hara, the idea is to come to a point of Yashlim Yito, where the Yetzer Hara makes peace with us, where we're actually able to utilize it. What happened at Har Sinai? The Yetzer Hara wasn't incorporated in. The Yetzer Hara was totally excluded. There was such an enormous sense of compulsion, there was such an enormous sense of clarity, that the Yetzer Hara didn't feature at all. And what happened straight afterwards? They were dancing around the golden calf. That never happened after Purim. That was one time when the whole of Bnei Israel, after Mount Sinai, when the Jews reached the highest level ever, 2 days later was the only time in Jewish history that the entire nation was serving idolatry, with a few individual exceptions. The only time that the entire nation served idolatry was right after Matan Torah. And after Purim, that never happened again, because there was a sense of commitment. They didn't get quite as high as they got in Matan Torah. They didn't hear God talking. Hashem's name isn't even mentioned in the Megillah. They didn't feel that enormous sense of compulsion. They didn't see fire on the mountain and hear the trumpets blowing and the shofar getting louder and louder and the mountain trembling and the whole world quaking. They didn't see any of that. Nothing. They didn't get to that level close to Nevuah, close to prophecy. They didn't see Moshe go up the mountain and come down with the Torah in his hands. They didn't see any of that. They just were living a normal, natural life. But what they did have came from within them. And what comes from within, even if it's much less, has much more power and is much more valuable than what comes from without. Bring a little bit out of the person himself, and that's worth a million times more than imposing a lot on the person from the outside. Much, much more. And never again did it happen after Kiyumu v'Kiblu that the whole nation was dancing around the golden calf, because it was internalized for the first time. And so it was with Odom HaRishon. When Odom was created, there was such clarity. He knew exactly what was what. The Yetzer Hara was outside of him. He hadn't dealt with the Yetzer Hara. He hadn't engaged with the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara was irrelevant. And when the Yetzer Hara is irrelevant, it's at its most dangerous. When anything is irrelevant, it's at its most dangerous. It's only when you engage with it and deal with it that it can be controlled, that it can be properly handled. When it's irrelevant, it's terribly dangerous. And in Adam's short life before he committed the sin, the Yetzer Hara was irrelevant. It just didn't feature at all. He was created by the Ribbono Shel Olam. He saw and perceived God, understood God, feared God, and there was such an enormity of clarity that it was very similar to the case of Matan Torah at that moment. That was like Matan Torah. He saw God, he knew God, there was no question of the consequences of doing avos. Everything was absolutely clear. But a moment later, the Ribbono Shel Olam wasn't evident. He wasn't, at that moment, tuned in to quite the same degree. And at that time, engaging with the Yetzer Hara, of dealing with the Yetzer Hara, of reaching a level ultimately of going right through the cycle and getting back to Biritzos Hashem Darkeish in the time of Mashiach, when Hashem will approve of the way we're doing things. Gam Oyavov Yashli Mito. The Yetzer Hara ceases to be an enemy. That's different. The Yetzer Hara was an enemy of Adam, alright, and how he was an enemy. It's just that he was irrelevant to Adam. That's when he got him. To us, the Yetzer Hara will never be irrelevant because we've dealt with him for 5,000 years, nearly 6,000 years. We know him very well. We've dealt with him, we've understood him, we've worked with him, we've worked against him. We'll never underestimate him. We understand exactly what it is and we've engaged him. Once we reach the level of Biritzos Hashem Darkeish, where Hashem starts approving of the way we're going, then although we might not reach a level as high as Adam HaRishon, we can't reach a level as high as Adam HaRishon. Adam was created by God's own hand. Adam was absolute purity. We can never reach that. Even after the time of Mashiach, we can't. Yet we'll reach a level where we won't make the same mistake as Adam. Adam in all his greatness and Adam in all his purity slipped up. And we will be able to be in a position where we won't. Just as the Jews after Purim did not reach a level as high as Matan Torah, they didn't reach the level of the Dor HaMidbar of that generation, but they were able to incorporate what Torah they had far more, in a far more integrated way, so to say, than those who were at Har Sinai, to the extent that they didn't make the same slipper. Those at Har Sinai danced around the golden calf, those in Shushan didn't. So exactly it will be that at the time of Mashiach, although we won't reach that same level of Adam HaRishon, we will certainly have, through the experience of working through the Yetzer Hara, gotten to a level of being able to be Mashlimita, when he, the Yetzer Hara, will become an integrated part of us, working for our Avodas Hashem, working for the Ribbono Shel Olam, not working against us. And that's something that we need to understand, not only in terms of the Messianic era, but in terms of everything we do and in every way we handle. To understand that it's really only when we've worked through issues that we can master them. And at the end of having worked through issues, we might not be as great as others who haven't had to work through the issues. The kind of thing perhaps that faces us living the kind of lives that we do every day, and the kind of conflicts. Sometimes we say to ourselves, wouldn't it be nice to be able to be sitting in Bnei Brak, or to be able to be sitting in Yerushalayim, protected from the conflicts we have to go through, protected from the worries that we have, the concerns that we have. They have other worries, but wouldn't it be nice to exchange that? And the answer is that Ribbono Shel Olam puts each person in the place where he has to be. But one thing we have to understand, that I don't think it's possible for us to spend many hours a day working and doing all sorts of other things to reach the same level of purity as a person who's sitting and learning only Torah all day. That's not possible. It's not necessarily possible for us to reach the same levels of knowledge of the Torah and understanding of the Torah. But that doesn't mean that we can't become as great. Just as Adam HaRishon, just as in the time of Mashiach, we won't be as great as Adam HaRishon. But nor will we make the same mistakes, because we will have had an experience that Adam didn't have. The experience of engaging with the Yetzer Hara for thousands of years, that gives us an experience of Yashlimito, of incorporating that Yetzer Hara and mastering it and dominating it totally, where it becomes a part of us, not irrelevant to us. And just as Bnei Yisrael after Purim were able to retain their level and not drop straight away afterwards, because they become committed rather than simply complying as a result of an external source of compulsion. So it is, as we grapple with the problems that we have to grapple with, and as we deal with the issues that we have to deal with, as distracting as they are, and as conflict-ridden as they are, and as tension-causing as they are, at least in dealing with them, we're able to handle them, to overcome them, to engage in them, and in the process to reach the levels where Birtzos Hashem Darkeish, if we handle these challenges correctly, if we handle these difficulties correctly, and live our lives in a way that is Birtzos Hashem, that Hashem approves of, Gam Oyevov Yashli Mito, these distractions, these negatives that we're dealing with, will become part of our lives in a positive way. Yashli Mito, they'll make peace with us and will become supportive of us. And as a result of that, at the end of it, we'll be far greater having gone through it than having ignored them and seen them as irrelevant in the first place. That's the kind of idea that we need to be working for, and the full understanding that the grappling with these issues don't have to be seen as negative all the way. They're negative until they're conquered. Once they're conquered, Yashli Mito, they make peace with us and make us greater ever than we've been before.